Right. Okay. So, all I wanted to do, which Sam convinced me to come in and do today, when I wrote it, I've written it for a different conference, and it was 45 minutes long, so I've cut a load of slides out and cut it down. Got no idea if this is going to make sense, but the slides are really pretty, so sit close enough so that you can see the slides. So this is the kind of basic structure. So there's the usual preamble. There's a bit about the power of blogging, and then there's a bit about the peril of blogging. Particularly, this is not really about blogging personally, but about setting up blogs at work, particularly for specific kinds of institutions that I've worked for until really recently. And just look me up on Twitter and you'll know what I'm talking about. So the preamble. So somebody much smarter than me once wrote, "Make things open, it makes things better." I believe it was number 10 on some list somewhere on the internet. This was like, on that list, this was the one that always chimed most with me, because it was something I was already committed to. It was something that had already, why I was interested in the web. I did an archaeology degree, for Christ's sake, so I've got no kind of background in this stuff. I just fell into it because the kind of culture suited me. And this is the beauty of blogging. Extra points if anyone knows the movie. You're weak. Come on. Die Hard 4, there we go. He was actually playing a hacker, but that just... A guy in his basement, in his tracky bottoms, blogging. That's pretty much how we were all considered until relatively recently. If you were a blogger, I bet you were, still. Don't heckle. So I love blogging. There's a pretty strong case to be made that the only reason I do the jobs I do, the only reason I work at my society and I used to be a civil servant, is so that I have something to blog about. It is the main reason I've always been interested in kind of internet culture. My head has been turned over the years by other platforms. I had a long-term affair with Twitter. But my true love has always been blogging. And I think that's because it's important. I mean, the conversation might have moved from blog comments, but the conversation starters are still on blogs. And this is what the thing, when I realised that blogging could be useful, is this old saying everyone knows, you know, dance like no one is watching, which is pretty much me at every wedding. But this other one is blog like no one is reading. So the most important thing I learned about blogging, for me personally, was the minute you stop caring about your audience, you stop caring about writing for other people, and start doing it to make things better for yourself, it actually becomes useful for other people. It's like the exact opposite of everything I've been telling people about user-centric design for the last decade. This is about designing for yourself, for writing for yourself, because it's only then that you can truly like make sense of it and actually make it useful. Anyone remember these guys? Before they kind of created a little evil robot that printed things out that were pointless and blew it. So Berg were amazing. Berg did loads of amazingly wonderful things. But the one thing that I remember most of all is they used to write week notes. So on their blog, every week, they wrote a little kind of narrative about what they were doing, following it through their projects, explaining what they were doing. They wrote it kind of like a little geeky serial, so like there were characters and it kind of followed through. And this always stuck with me. This is always this thing that basically whenever I got stuck, whenever I had writer's block, wherever I needed to make sense of something, I turned to this idea of week notes. And I still write them. I do them in kind of seasons, 24 weeks of a year, basically. And now there's a few of us, I've convinced a few other people to write them as well, and I collect them on a little blog. It's all gone a bit quiet now, because at least a few of the others are in Perda, and they've lost their nerve. This is the first time I've ever not been in Perda during my adult life, so I'm feeling quite smug about it. So that was the kind of the background. And then, so there's no geek talk can be without a picture of Steve Jobs. 2007, the most important thing that actually happened in 2007 wasn't the release of the iPhone. I launched a blog network. I worked for an organisation who funded research across higher education, lots and lots of different projects, lots and lots of different universities, lots of money. And the thing that happened with that money is people got given stuff. At the end of the research project, they wrote a report, got turned into a PDF, and no one read it. And I just discovered WordPress. It was like 0.1 on the multi-site, so I was a classic case of just knowing enough to be dangerous. So I decided we would build a blog network for everyone who got project funded and make them blog about their projects for other funding. Then we would also archive those blogs so the information would never get lost. It's still there. It's like the only thing of mine that I've ever led that lasted, so I'm quite proud of it. But this became my kind of go-to move. I went to organisations that were really risk-averse, and whether I had permission or not, I set up blogs. At ONS, this meant actually setting up a WordPress.com blog, conning somebody in the IT team to map a domain to it, thinking it was something different than it was, and then me paying it for 3 years on my own credit card, to the extent I only recently stopped paying for it, and I've been gone 9 months. But this became my move, was to kind of set up blogs, convince other people to do it, and kind of just get people involved. And why was the point in doing this, of all the things, blogs, and why not do Facebook or Twitter and that sort of thing? So one of the reasons was changing perceptions. So I'll refer back to ONS a bit in this. It's like, the ONS had an incredibly bad reputation, almost as bad as NHS IT. But the thing about this was that there were loads and loads of great people working on the digital side, working on the IT side, who just had no way of speaking, no way of talking to people about what they'd been up to. They'd been left with no right to reply. And they needed a channel, they needed a way to speak for themselves, to fight back, and to demonstrate that they weren't all these clueless clowns who were making these terrible decisions. Now, leadership might be something different, but there were loads of people on the ground who knew what they were talking about and needed the opportunity. And one of the other things that we found we could do, and I listened to a podcast recently by Russell Davis, where he mentioned this as well, so I knew it's not just me, is you can change by stealth. We did a lot of blogging where we basically kind of announced things as if they were real. And then the organisation were too embarrassed not to go through with it. So you would kind of do change by, you just like sneak changes out into the world. And then the other one is kind of publish, don't send. Like someone else at DDS like logged this quite early on. And it's quite an interesting idea. But actually it's the first time actually fixing the whole kind of organisational knowledge thing, actually, you know, taking things out of just the chosen few's inboxes and sharing it amongst the whole organisation, making it searchable, makes a massive difference to organisations. But it also, it's great for recruitment, because people can see the kind of organisation you are. But it only matters if you share the failures. The whole thing with all of this is, if you're not showing the kind of the work that went into it, the compromises that had to be made, all the twists and turns you have to take, then what's the point of blogging? All you're doing is spinning stuff. And that's one of the reasons, this is my favourite slide, is that it's a canary down the mine. You can tell whether an organisation's culture is the right kind of culture for you, whether it's changing what's going on there, but just by watching if they've got a blog and if the blog changes. It's the way people are writing, the kind of people who are writing. If that all changes, you start to get a feel for how organisations are changing and the culture. Because if you've got that, if people aren't sharing the failures and the problems and you can see the culture, it's what I call product propaganda. So it's just all unicorns and rainbows. It's all just about all the positivity and all the good days and everything's great and everything's perfect. And no one learns from any of that. You know, you can only learn from the kind of the journey, and it's actually the destination is very often the least interesting part of it. This slide's just in it because I wanted this slide in it. The bit about fake news is no longer in the talk, but I like the slide. And this is the other thing. So one of the things you absolutely know, particularly if you're in a big institutional organisation, that you're stuffed, is the minute the equation becomes press officers plus bloggers, you're screwed. Press releases are not the same as blogging. Press releases have a different reason for existing, have a different attitude. Everything about them is there to achieve a different goal than running good blogs. And the minute those things, the minute you become successful and people are aware of you enough that it draws the attention of the press office, who until that point would have just thought you were an annoyance, this is where things actually get quite sticky. And at this point, you often find that no one talks in their own voice anymore. So the blogs become we and not I. It becomes a corporate voice and not individuals. And then again, you lose it. You know they're being rewritten. You know that there's some, that, you're, that things are being kind of polished up before they go in public. And the only rule of blogging is don't blog about blogging. Anything else than that just gets in the way. So the minute you're in a situation where you're part of a wider comms plan and you're on some kind of comms grid and you're getting told when to publish when and how and what your audience is and all that sort of thing, then it's not a blog anymore, it's a communications channel, and you can start to see that that everything about it just changes its attitude. And this, you won't see, so this is Tony's fault, we speak in next. So you won't see many quotes from Milton Friedman at Open Tech, it's safe to say. But this is an amazing quote. It took me a bit, like Tony just randomly told me it, and then I had to like dig it up properly. But this is an amazing thing, and this is what blogging is about. By blogging openly and sharing all this sort of thing and doing things out in the public, you leave ideas lying around for other people to find. Because it's there, it's on Google, you can Google it, people point it to it, you link to it. It's not lost behind any paywalls anywhere. It's just there. And then people can come and they can learn and they can find out what they need to know and just pick things up. And also just learn from your mistakes. Like almost all of the most popular things I've ever written are being about where I screwed up. And I think that's the reality. Like sharing kind of those lessons is important. It's just this ends all my talk tonight. Who watches Silicon Valley? Yeah. So it's a character. So I don't want to live in a world where someone else makes a better place, or a better place than us. So that's it. Thanks.
Tony, that's going to be that smooth. That's how good we are here. Over to you. Tony is also from my society. This is not a stitch up, honestly.
Thank you. I'm not talking about anything My Society related. I'm following on nicely from Juicy's talk about what sort of ideas we should be lying around, where we get ideas, what we do with them. And a large part of it is a sort of personal bugbear of mine that in the UK we tend to want to invent our own ideas, but we actually live in a world where there's millions of great ideas and we should start stealing them much, much more. So I lived for most of the last 10 years in Estonia, which I personally think is the best country in the world, and I'll happily argue that with anybody. But that's because it's a country that thrives on ideas and makes ideas happen and is willing to try things and experiment with things. It's the most sort of technologically advanced country I've ever lived in. And they deliberately based the entire future of the country around the internet in the early 90s, and it paid off very, very well for them, to the extent that lazy journalists always write articles about them being Estonia and sort of play off this. But really, it's a country that is digital by default everywhere. Lots of the things that GDS tried to do in the UK over the last few years, lots of them they stole from Estonia. And that's from the very, very basic level of society right the whole way through. Now, it's almost impossible to pay your car parking with cash or anything like that. Everybody pays either by SMS or smartphones and has done for 10 years. But it goes the whole way through to the fabric of your interaction primarily with government. So they completely digitized their health service a decade ago and have reaped massive benefits from that. Shortly after I moved there, they took the next step of that, which was their electronic prescription system, which, sort of, again, none of what they do is earth-shattering. They just make the simple things work and make sense the whole way through. So when you're ill, you go to the doctor, they give you a prescription, but you don't get anything. It just goes straight into the system so that when you go to the pharmacy, they know who you are, they know what you can get, and they know what way that's being paid for, because the way their health system works, you either pay 0, 25%, 50%, 75%, or 100% of that, and it's all just built into the system. There's no room for error on any of those sorts of things. But of course, they follow things through. One of the big problems in the UK that we all know with any sort of IT system is that they're usually a mess and even when you end up with something, they haven't really thought it through very well. So, of course, the problem with something like a prescription system is very often you're too sick to go and get stuff. That's the whole point. So they built it into the system right from the start that you could delegate that authority to anyone. You can sit at home on your computer and say, this person is allowed to go and pick up my prescription for me, and everything just works. That followed the whole way through to things like the social welfare system. It's not only for nice, rich part of society. All the benefit systems were consolidated into one system because they discovered that it was a real mess that no one could navigate. No one knew what they were entitled to or how to get them. So again, anybody can log on if they don't have internet at home. And by the way, Estonia was the first country to ever declare internet access a basic human right. But anybody can go on from a library, from anywhere, and have full access to what their entitlements are, how to get them, the history of everything, and all their health and employment stuff is all connected to that if they give it the proper permissions, so that everything just flows smoothly. Same with schooling. They've simplified everything to do with schools. And again, similar to the health system and things like that, it's not a big centralized system. All the schools, all the hospitals, whatever, can have their own systems, but they do mandate that those export data in the right format so that the central systems can read them, so you don't need to navigate those. So if you have children at multiple schools, you can log on to a central school portal, which will pull in all the information from all the places and just make all that sort of stuff so simple for you. I've been back in the UK for a couple of years. I've been looking at the issues around buying property here, and after living in Estonia for 10 years, it's madness. We heard people talk this morning about all sorts of issues about the UK property system, and being in Estonia, that's so simple. They work really, really hard to bring buying a house down from effectively a three-month process, kind of like it is here, to being able to do it in a week. All the information that you would want about any property is on the central system about that. You can see on a map exactly where it is, what the boundaries of it are, who owns it, what mortgages are on it, what rights of way they are, all the sort of thing you want to know. You do not even need a solicitor in Estonia to buy property. Everything's just done with a notary signing off and putting the information back into the system. None of this stuff is complex. It just needs people to demand that it happens. And you can look at places like Estonia for a model of how it does work. It's not even about, wouldn't it be nice if maybe a system could work like this, and then everybody explains to you why it can't. You can look at these sorts of systems in countries like Estonia and say, no, they've made it work. Why can't we have that? And again, if we sit here and try to dream up what sort of system we want from nothing, then you're always open to people coming back and saying, that's just not possible. If you look at systems that already exist in the rest of the world and say, we want that, it's much easier to start agitating for change. Yeah, I don't have enough time to go into that stuff. Another example I want to look at a bit of depth is Bogota in Colombia. Going back 20, 25 years, it was one of the most dangerous cities in the world. It was overrun by drug cartels. It had one of the highest murder rates in the world. And then they got a very crazy Lithuanian, became mayor. He used to be the rector of the university. He was already quite odd there and quite controversial. He had brought in a system where everyone could pay whatever fees they thought they could afford. And in that, he found that numerous people who could afford it actually paid more than they'd been paying before, and it all evened out, even though people said it would never work. But he sort of came to prominence because there were lots of riots going on at the time, particularly with student bodies and things like that. And at a big public event at the university, people were rioting, they were throwing things at the stage, they were yelling, he couldn't talk. And he kind of lost it. And he just got in the middle of the stage, dropped his trousers, mooned the audience. And everyone was like, whoa, how do we deal with things like this? Now, he had a very deep-rooted belief in why that sort of thing is important. He believed in the power of spectacle. He believed in all sorts of non-violent responses to things. But, of course, none of the press stories about this picked on this. It was a major news story. It was the rector of the leading university in the country. And, of course, he was fired. But he so captured the public imagination that there was a mayoral election happening at the time, and everybody kind of demanded that he run. And he won with the largest majority that the country had ever seen in an election. So suddenly this weird academic, who has no political background, who's an independent, who has no connection to the political elites or the drug cartels or all the people who effectively ran the city, found himself running a city. So he did what any sensible person would do and declared himself a superhero, ran around in a cape, picking up litter, tearing down like fly posting, all these sorts of things. And again, he believed that it's not about telling the citizens of a city what they should do. Now, context, this was just at the same time that Rudy Giuliani became mayor of New York City, who was one of those authoritarian approaches that you can take to a city. He brought in his zero tolerance policy. Bogota had much worse problems, but Antanas Mockus, who took over, believed there were much better ways of going about this. So one of the things he's most famous for was he fired all the traffic police and replaced them with mime artists. Because he realised that in that Latin American, very macho culture, just finding people and getting police involved had zero effect. What actually worked with trying to change things like that was ridiculing people, laughing at people, embarrassing them. People didn't want that. So mime artists were perfect. They roam the streets looking for someone, blocking traffic, coming out at the wrong time, speeding. They would jump out in front of them, point at them, stop all the rest of the traffic, and get everybody to point at them and laugh at them. Way more effective. But then he took that another stage further, and they printed up red cards to distribute to everyone in the city, so that when they saw somebody doing something they didn't like, instead of turning it into some sort of violent thing or not wanting to get involved in case it became a violent thing, they could just hold up a red card and say, I don't like what you're doing. Because he rightly realised that his time as a mayor would be quite short. He didn't want to just change behaviour by saying, this is what should happen, but realised that the way to have a good society is get the people to decide what sort of city they want to live in and try to make it happen themselves. And so a lot of what he was doing was getting people to realise how bad the city had become and what they would want it to be like. So again, it was a city with lots of gun crime and very high rates of just random killings on streets and things like that. So he had a gun amnesty. Lots of people have tried things like this. But of course, he's a crazy Lithuanian, so he takes it a stage further. And when you bring in your gun, the police just don't confiscate it. They melted it down, turned it into a spoon. Which you would have engraved on it, whatever the Spanish is for, I used to be a gun. And give this back to people. And of course, this was just a crazy way of getting people to engage differently, to view the world in a slightly different way, to dream up the sort of society they wanted to live in. He realised that it had become the sort of city no one wanted to go out at nights, and particularly women didn't want to go out at night. So he decided to declare one night just women's night, and went on TV and said, yeah, I'm only the mayor, I don't have power to enforce this, but please, men, all stay at home this night. I want only women to go out, I want them to have a good time, I want them to enjoy life on their own. And of course, lots of women did this, and they realised, hey, we've missed actually being able to go out and have fun and be safe and enjoyable. And of course, lots of them had friends or family or whatever who were drug dealers or criminals or all sorts of stuff, who then went back and nagged their husbands and boyfriends and said, cut it out, we want to be able to live in a city where we can do this sort of stuff. And he followed through on the policy he had at the university of allowing people to pay what they want, and managed to persuade the top 1% of taxpayers or earners in Bogota to voluntarily pay an extra 10% tax to fund all this. Now, not all of them did, but a substantial enough amount of them did, because they realised it was in their interests to live in a better society. So there's all sorts of creative ways you can make these things work. Yeah, I don't have a lot of time for lots of great examples, but I can talk about a few more. Sao Paulo, in Brazil, one of the biggest cities in the world, largest city in the Southern Hemisphere, largest city in the Americas, did a phenomenal thing about 4 or 5 years ago. They banned all outdoor advertising. And they did it under the existing pollution laws. They just decreed it to be visual pollution. So far as I know, it hasn't been reversed. There were legal challenges against it and all this sort of stuff, but they basically decided the sort of city we want to live in doesn't have this, and made it happen. Great idea. Brazil's actually great for this. I've loads of stories for Brazil if we had more time, largely because they push power down. So state level and particularly city level, people can make things happen. So Belo Horizonte, which is the sixth or seventh biggest city in Brazil, again, have effectively abolished hunger just by deciding that they would. They declared food a basic right and took lots of steps to do it. But one of the most effective was they created what they call the people's restaurants, where anybody can go and eat for free. So it doesn't work quite the same way as things like food banks, because they worked really hard to make sure there was no stigma attached to it. And in fact, they constantly promote the idea that it's everyone's civic duty to go and eat there at least once a month. Because then the people who actually need to go and eat there more often don't feel embarrassed by it, they don't think there's anything wrong with it. And effectively, they abolished hunger within the city within about a year. Well, there's always edge cases and things like this, but it was a phenomenal job, and I think it works out as something like 1 cent per day per person as the expense of it of the citizens of the place. It was a ridiculously small amount. And again, a lot of it's interesting that you can do these sorts of things at a city level. Another example that I really have a lot of time to talk about is what happened in Reykjavik in Iceland a few years back, where a bunch of kind of anarchist, comedian, musician types set up a spoof political party called The Best Party, made wonderful ads using Tina Turner's Simply the Best, promised all sorts of crazy things like a new polar bear and free towels at the swimming pools and all, like a drug-free parliament, but very explicitly were saying, yeah, this is all a joke. Everybody ignored them until about 2 days before the election when all the polls showed them winning. And they did. They didn't get an outright majority, but they were the largest party, so they got to form the city government. He became mayor. So they needed to form a coalition, and they said they would only enter into a coalition with anybody who had watched every episode of The Wire. So how can you possibly understand how a city should work if you haven't? Now, again, they're a slightly odd example because they didn't follow through on their policies, but they explicitly had new policies that weren't jokes. But essentially, they turned the city around at a point when it was effectively bankrupt. But the point I want to make from that is that we live in interesting times. We have seen people come out of nowhere, become politicians, take power in very large countries. And we have it, we even have it in the UK. So I'm living in Bristol these days. And when they got an elected mayor there, it was an independent candidate who was kind of crazy. Again, didn't follow through so well on things. But again, we live in a world where it is more likely than ever before that we can end up with different people in power who don't have the same political allegiances before, who can actually change things in different ways, and who are usually actively looking for interesting ideas. Again, the Milton Friedman quote, the Dukes he put up, you know, at times of crisis, that's when people look around for interesting ideas. Disagreement?
Yeah, no? I live in Bristol too, and this present mayor doesn't do that.
Oh yeah, no, that's what I said. It's the fact that it happened was the interesting thing. As I said, he didn't follow through on things. And that was a problem in Iceland as well, but in other places it hasn't been. And part of the reason there is because we're not asking people to do these things. The meta point of my talk here is let's steal ideas from loads of other places and force people locally to do them. And it works. We've seen it happen in a few interesting places. So one of the ideas that Estonia stole from Finland is the idea of baby boxes, which have been in the news quite a bit over the last couple of years, where every baby that's born, the state gives the parents sort of a box full of useful things, of clothing, of bed linen, of nappies, books, toys, all sorts of stuff. And the box itself even doubles up as a crib if you would need to. Finland's had that since about the 1930s, when it had the highest infant mortality rates in Europe. They brought that in as a way of getting parents to go and register for prenatal care. So as long as you registered before the fourth month, you would get this when the baby was born. And over the course of the next 50 years or so, they dropped so that they were pretty much the lowest infant mortality rates in Europe because they were getting much better care out of things like this. That idea lay around there for 50 years with no one other than Estonia copying it. But in the last 4 or 5 years, I don't know how it happened, but somehow this entered the public consciousness and loads of countries have adopted it, including Scotland, but not England. But again, when an idea is out there, you know, it's kind of, there's a quote that if I had slides would be up and all this sort of stuff, I go, nothing in the world is more powerful than an idea whose time has come. Or what I want everybody here to do is go find great ideas, share them as widely as possible, push people to make them happen, and end up in a better world.
Thank you so much, Tony. I want to listen to you all day. Unfortunately, we've got a bit of time. I've also forgot to say that my name's Catherine right at the beginning. I often forget to do this, and I'm from Represent Me. And the reason I remember that is also Ed. It's not meant to be this way, but Ed is also from Represent Me, and he founded it. So, Ed, over to you.
Thanks. Do I need a microphone?
Yes, you do.
Okay, all right. It's kind of tough to follow all of that, because that sounds so much more fun than what I'm about to talk about. But what do you do if you haven't got a cool mayor? What do you do if there are ideas that are lying around all over the place and people want them to happen, but they keep on not happening? And we keep on not having the nice things that we all know are possible, and we keep on struggling to make them real and implement them? That's the problem that we're working on. We're trying to make it so that democracy and civic power in democracy is more potent, more effective, and more transparent. And I think actually, since we're telling stories about other cool things that can be done, there's, does anyone from New Zealand? Proportional representation in New Zealand, how that got adopted is fucking awesome. So if you compare this with the referendum that we've just had last year, in New Zealand, they said, okay, they had 4 separate votes around this one referendum issue of proportional representation. They said, firstly, fundamentally, should we bother with any of the next 3 votes after this one point? Do we think that proportional representation is even vaguely a good idea? And the people said, yes. Cool, we will go away and we will have a royal commission which will look at all those single transferable votes and multi-member system and all that sort of stuff, and come back with a recommendation. They did, and the Royal Commission said, we think you should have single transferable vote. And the people went. And there was another referendum on which method to choose if they go ahead and have proportional representation. And the people said, no, not STV, we're going to go with mixed member system or mixed member representation, something like that. Sorry? There we go. Mixed member proportional representation. And I always get confused with mixed martial arts. I was like MMA in the parliament. And so the people say, yeah, if we go ahead with it, we will have MMP, I guess. And then they said, okay, vote number 3, shall we actually go ahead and do that? Before we vote number 4 will be in 15 years' time. Where we will check, is that okay, did anything break? So don't worry, we can do vote number 3, knowing that you can't go that far wrong. Vote number 3, do you want PR? Yes, said the people. Vote number 4, do you want to keep PR? Yes, said the people. So that is what's possible. That's the kind of debate that you can have with your citizens. That's the kind of discursive democracy that is possible, that people can do responsibly, openly, transparently, honestly, authentically. And that's what we don't have here. How do you make that happen when your government resists it? Which effectively they are by not offering that choice. So what we're doing is we're making it very, very easy we built a platform called Represent. It basically asks you a question, you answer that question, it goes on your profile, we take all of the data, we map it, it's all open data, it's all anonymous yet public, as you would expect from, you know, here. And it means you can pull out all sorts of interesting insights. You can see who's engaged, who's not engaged. You can see where people want what and why. So you can see the most compelling reasons. You can see, in fact, it was when I was living in Bristol that I thought about it. And it was what would Mayweather look like? If I was George Ferguson, what would I want to engage effectively with my city? I'd want to know where people want to put cycle lanes. I want to know where people have a problem with recycling. I want to know where people enjoy their parks or have a problem with litter collection. I want to know where people do like their schools and don't like their schools. And I want to be able to do so regularly, cheaply. And then I want to be able to use that data to empower the people to take action and do things about it if they want to. So who wants to join an electric car club? Who wants to play football tonight? And you can find out when you've got these trigger points, these little moments, where there is enough tipping point for collective action to make something happen, or a tipping point for where council action should happen. There is nothing stopping us doing this on our own right now, and we're doing it. We've got an open platform that has got an open API, so you can build, if any of what I'm saying sounds interesting, you can just jump in and build stuff on top of it. We've got public profiles around what people want, and the ability to do things like sort by consensus in an area. So you can say, okay, here's London. What do we want? When the chief digital officer comes in London, they can go, okay, what do people want from London's transport system? Transport, sort by consensus, go, there's your to-do list. So one of the other things that we do is, if you've got all of this information, in fact, let's go with the idea of petitions, right? Who signed a petition? Who signed one of the government petitions? Who has had one of those petitions lead to anything meaningful? Okay. Two hands went up. Quite a lot of hands went up, but about 80% of hands went up, most of them. For the first two questions, two hands went up in the end. What was it, Catherine? What was it?
Can't remember now. Sorry. But something happened.
Give meaningful participation. Change your life.
I'll look at my emails.
Yeah. Who signed 38 degrees petitions? Change.org? Part of the problem with petitions is the idea of petition fatigue. We sign them and we go, okay, that's cool and I agree with that. And then we get another one, and we probably agree with that one as well. And then we get another one, and we probably agree with that one as well. Why can't you just say to 38 degrees, like, guys, I agree with you. Go. to come up with things. Check with me every now and again. Just sign them on my behalf. And in fact, whilst we're there, let's have a disagree button on all our petitions as well, so that they can actually become effective moments of democracy, that we can go to our MPs and say, yes, we have canvassed everybody on these issues. We have, this does count as representative data. But that act of delegating your vote to 38 degrees or to someone that you trust to take a decision on that topic on your behalf is a really powerful idea. So at the moment, we're about to go to an election. Who's registered to vote, by the way? Good. Who's going to vote? Also good. Unfortunately, it's going to do almost nothing because the majority of people aren't going to get the candidate that you voted for. We have a first-past-the-post system, so we don't have the representatives that we want in Parliament. We don't have the candidates that actually represent us with the kind of fidelity that we need them to represent us with. You also only have about 14 elections in your lifetime with which you can express any of this, the volition for your ideas. So how can we make that more granular? How can we take that vote that you delegate to one person for every single topic for the next 5 years and break that apart? What we let you do is delegate by topic. So you can say, For the environment, I want the Green Party. For health, I want Lib Dems. For defence, I want Labour. And so pick these topics. But not just do it to parties, but to also do it to individuals. And so I could say, look, well, I was trying to think of something that I can delegate to someone in this room, from a speech I've just heard. If I want to political innovation, I'll delegate to James. For open government, we could delegate to pretty much anyone in this room, I guess. So that allows you to open up a lot more data around what people want. It allows you to, most importantly, surface the expertise that you have within your constituency and within your country. It allows you to harness that expertise and do useful things with it. So those ideas that are lying around, they don't just lie there dormant, waiting for someone to come along and somehow magically attain a critical mass. You give it the mechanism to attain that critical mass. You build that snowball so that one person votes on that issue. When they do vote, they know that they're carrying 20,000 votes on it, which in a constituency is kind of important and can swing the way it works. So far, so nice and sort of utopian and complex and not very well articulated. I'm sorry about that. But how do you actually make it real and how do you make it meaningful? So, okay, 2 minutes for I thought we had 15. Never mind. So what we're doing from October is that we are building a citizens advisory parliament. So last year we were contacted by parliament saying, you know, we have an outreach organisation, outreach group that push out questions and get information back again. They counted 200 replies as being a success for a consultation on a bill. We get thousands. And so what we're doing is we're going to take the key issues of note, the bills of note, create a set of germane questions around them, push them out to the public. The public can vote on them. We send those results to MPs, where they're also published, obviously, so that everyone has access to them. Send the results to MPs with analysis by constituency and national. Then when your MP votes, they can also have a right of reply during that debating period. When your MP votes, we notify you how they voted and how much you agree or disagree with them. We can then do that at the end of every month, year, electoral cycle. This is how much you've agreed with this person this year. If you disagree with them, you can start to delegate your vote off to other people, which means you can start to surface those ideas and work effectively with other constituents and other people to bring those ideas to the attention of the decision maker. What we're doing before then is trying to get it so that up until the 8th of June, essentially, 9th of June, no one's going to give a shit about politics. Up until the 8th of June, people will be paying attention, trying to work out who to vote for. So what we're trying to do until then is get it so that people can compare candidates, get information about who to vote for, and most importantly, track the effectiveness of the party that they do vote for through the next, the effectiveness of their MP through the next electoral cycle. So if there are any questions, so that I can finish on time, about working together, that would be fantastic.
Thank you, Ed.